ESPN College Football Podcast, hosted by Matt Barry.
It is your Monday tradition, unlike any other, the ESPN College Football Podcast. However, you're getting the all-Thursday team. Roddy Jones, Matt Barry alongside. Together we called the ESPN Thursday Night College Football. And so, Roddy, you know, last week we had you on SportsCenter, or the week before we had you on SportsCenter. I think what's happening here is that I'm having separation anxiety.
It's good because I'm having it as well. I told you I was going to FaceTime you last week, my wife, because we weren't going to see each other on Thursday. My wife advised against that. She was like, you guys need some time away from each other. But I got to tell you, this feels right.
It does feel right. When you spend, 14 weeks together, we got a bowl game coming up, doing the Pinstripe Bowl on the 29th. Looking forward to that. I think it'll be Maryland and Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
Is the game that we'll be calling. So it is going to be a fun bowl season. They get underway this weekend, 17th and 18th is when everything gets started. But today, Rod, I think that one of the big stories I want to get to, two things. One, we'll talk about early signing day, which happens in 2 days, December 15th. And two, a busy day in the transfer portal when it comes to quarterbacks. Zach Calzada, Texas A&M, he announced. Bo Nix, he announced. He joins Max Johnson, who already announced. This is the new normal in college football, which is quarterbacks taking the opportunity to go elsewhere.
Yeah, and it's not always the guys that you think. Like, I just saw Keaton Slovis jumped in the portal.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a guy with Lincoln Riley coming to town that you would think, hey, man, if you go out and you compete and you can win the job with Lincoln Riley as your head coach and play caller, like, you got to, honestly, history says you got a pretty good shot at being in New York for the Heisman Trophy ceremony. But winning that job is the big thing. So it's just interesting when these quarterbacks, it seems like to me, when these quarterbacks are not guaranteed jobs, like, hey, this is your job. If you're a starter, if you're Slovis or Calzada or Nix, if it's not guaranteed that you're going to be the starter next year, they're just finding greener pastures elsewhere, somewhere where they feel like they've got either a better shot to be named the starter, or a situation that's certainly more favorable from a quarterback room standpoint if they're walking into a competition.
Yeah, because Jackson Dart, he's a highly recruited kid that Lincoln Riley's going to inherit as well. You get that Malachi, forget his last name, five-star kid, who committed to Oklahoma initially, decommitted and followed Lincoln to L.A. So Slovis didn't shock me. Calzada, Bo Nix, and Max Johnson, all three of them shocked me because Max was the entrenched starter at LSU. And I can't believe that he wouldn't fit in what Brian Kelly was trying to do. The Max Johnson one was surprising. Calzada took over for Haynes King when he got hurt, played well. That's a Jimbo Fisher recruit. That was a little surprising. And then the Bo Nix legacy thing, those three, Rod, for me, kind of got a dog head tilt out of me because it seemed as if all three of them were in a perfect position to not only compete, but win a starting job.
Yeah. I think that when you look at, especially the Nix one and the Johnson one, or excuse me, the Nix one and the Calzada one, like there's no coaching change that's happening there either. So again, I think it's a conversation that's had between Bo Nix and Brian Harsin or Zach Calzada and Jimbo Fisher. And it's like, hey, look, I was the starter this year. Am I the starter next year? And it's almost like if the answer is not yes, you are our starter for next year. You're going to get all the reps. You're going to be the guy. People are leaving. I think the Max Johnson one with guys transferring with head coaches coming in, I don't really know what that's about, man. I went through a coaching change, and like there's some anxiety when you have that coaching change on what exactly it's going to be like once the new coach arrives. What's the new offensive coordinator going to do? What's the new system going to be like? Just your daily activities, your schedule, your practice, all that. But it's not like there's less of that when you go somewhere else.
Right.
So at least when you're at the school that you know, there's some familiarity with classes and where stuff is, literally like physically where stuff is, which you don't have to learn. So that one kind of is a head scratch to me. We've seen it at a number of places where a coach is transferring in or coaches is coming in and a guy decides to transfer out, it seems like, and you know, we're not in those guys' heads, but it seems like because of the fear of the unknown in what's coming, some of it may have to do with scheme. But as you said, in a Max Johnson case, like maybe he's looking for something else other than what Brian Kelly's run in the past. But it seems like he would fit in what Brian Kelly has done previously.
And I had read somewhere his brother's a highly touted tight end.
Yeah.
And they wanted to play together in college. Well,
if you want to be a tight end, like Brian Kelly's a pretty good place to go.
That guy's produced an NFL tight end annually. And with the decision, it looks like Quinn Ewers is going to go to Texas, the transfer from Ohio State. Right now, you're looking at a portal that's got Spencer Rattler, Bo Nix, 2 5-star studs out of high school.
Right.
So Spencer, Bo Nix, Keaton Slovis, Dylan Gabriel, Max Johnson, Miles Brennan, Cameron Ward, and Adrian Martinez. Yeah. So if you need a quick fix at quarterback, I mean, there are a lot of them out there. Those are some big-time names on that list.
Huge. And the Quinn Ewers thing is interesting to me because I think Quinn Ewers probably starts and finishes at Ohio State if he doesn't reclassify due to NIL. So like we were looking for sort of, you know, if you're looking for how NIL has affected the game, Quinn Ewers seems to be sort of the poster child because he comes into Ohio State a year earlier than he should have.
Should have been a senior at South Lake Carroll.
Correct. And then, so let's say he's a senior at South Lake Carroll. He enrolls in January. Well, he's sitting behind CJ Stroud for 1 year and then he's the heir apparent. Instead, because that clock started ticking, you can't waste. He likely, I don't know. I haven't talked to him. He likely feels like I can't waste another one of these years that I have in college by sitting behind CJ Stroud again. So
let me hop in right there real quick. Or did he take advantage of this NIL system, go ride Ohio State for $1 million in NIL?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Not lose a year of eligibility, be the most coveted prospect on the market, and finally come back to the place that he originally committed.
He did it. Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. I didn't think about it like that. I mean, that very well could be it too. So in terms of like how NIL has affected things, I think he's probably the most evident one. But to your point on what the transfer portal and what it is from a quarterback position, I think this is kind of going to be the norm, man. Like, I think you're going to have a stocked quarterback position in particular in the transfer portal on a year in, year out basis, full of either 5-stars that didn't start their freshman year or feel like they should be starting going into their second year or maybe aren't guaranteed a starting spot, and guys who have played who for whatever reason have felt like their time is up wherever they are and transfer elsewhere. So, you know, I don't know how much the big schools are going to continually dip in the transfer portal because they can get those 5-stars out of high school. But I do think coaches will start to make a living off of, hey, we've seen film of these guys play. Let's go pull a guy out of the portal for 1 or 2 years.
Roddy, Mel Tucker made 10 million or 10 years, 95 million on the transfer portal.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. He built his roster with portal players, Kenneth Walker being the biggest name, and he just got 10 years, $95 million for it.
I mean, Sonny Dykes got a Big 12 job out of it. Sonny Dykes at SMU. I mean, we had him a couple times this year. You look at what he did with Shane Buechele and then Tanner Mordecai. Like, that's sort of the model that he's followed. And so for these top end group of 5 schools, maybe mid-level power 5, and then occasionally you'll get some big power 5s like a Texas taking a Quinn Ewers. But I think it's going to be robust. People have used the term free agency. It's hard to argue against it, to be honest, at the quarterback position.
You know what? I believe now, as we kind of segue into the early signing day as it relates to the transfer portal, you and I have talked about this during our broadcasts ad nauseum about the portal and maybe having a designated date because we talk to these coaches all the time and they hate it. We won't give you names and they won't say it on the record, but they hate that the portal is open for business 24. It's like a Waffle House. It's just always open. It needs to be a date. But what you're seeing now, I really believe that coaches that aren't at the factories, the Alabamas, the Clemsons, the Georgias, the Ohio States, the Michigans, I think you're going to see every other program build on the portal. And I think high school recruiting is going to be borderline, not irrelevant, but much second tier going forward. Because if you're, let's just use, I don't know, give me a middle tier pro. I'll use my alma mater, Arizona State. They recruited at a high level.
You got to give Arizona State a little more credit than that. I mean,
I did coming into the season. They finished 8-4. But they've been recruiting youngster, good quality 4-star players at a high school. Some have since entered the portal. But if you're a middle of the conference program,
yeah,
why not let someone else do the high school recruiting and then pick and fill your needs with guys that have 2-3 years left that have already experienced college football? Why waste a time on a lot of unknown when you've got tape or some idea of a portal guy? I think this is going to impact high school recruiting going forward.
We've already seen it impact high school recruiting some, and it's hard to fully make it tangible, the effects of it. But I mean, Texas State, I believe it was this past class, an entire class with transfers, yep, because they were a young football team. They didn't need high school players, and COVID, they couldn't get out and evaluate guys. So you're able to not only see these guys on tape against players who, you know, there's a baseline in college football. Like if you're playing in the MAC currently, or you're playing in the SEC or the ACC, generally, I know what the level of competition is. So the way you look against that level of competition, it's really easy for me to evaluate. It's really difficult evaluating a guy who's playing 4A ball in Texas. It really is, because even in 4A ball in Texas, which is a great football state, the variance of what you get, yeah, from high school to high school is tough to know. So if you're looking at a highlight film or a full game, you've got to sort of evaluate, okay, how good are the people that he's playing against? And that's tough to know. Then there's the legwork on the back end. What kind of kid is he? What kind of student is he? All that stuff is done when you're going getting a transfer. So I agree. And you know, in talking to coaches, they've already said, hey, look, we save however many scholarships a year for transfers.
And that's going to keep going up.
And it is going to keep going up, particularly if you're not getting 4- and 5-star guys that everybody wants, or at developmental positions where you sort of have to have the depth. High school recruiting is still going to be the way you fill depth, like filling out an offensive line room. You're not going to be able to do that portal exclusively. But right, but at skill positions, if you need an impact player, like, I'm not looking for a freshman. I'm looking for a guy that's played.
I had a well-known head coach in college football tell me that he will never recruit a high school quarterback again. He is never going to offer, yeah, a high school quarterback again. He's going to be a portal guy. He's going to go find a Spencer Rattler, which, by the way, that Spencer Rattler would work perfect for this head coach.
Yeah.
But he'll go find a Rattler, ride him for 2 years. He might need some depth, you know, and that's where you go get your high school guy, but he's not going to hand the keys. He's just going to be portal. Pick off all these high school or all these quarterbacks from the portal. He said, I can make a living doing that.
I was talking to a coach, and then there's the other side of it where I was talking to a coach who is a Power 5 coach who's had some success at this level. And we were talking about recruiting quarterbacks. Like, how do you recruit that position now? Because, you know, if you go and you get a top tier quarterback, like 4- or 5-star quarterback, and he either doesn't play immediately or he struggles and maybe feels a little out of place of the place he is, like that kid is likely, or maybe not likely, but there's a significant percent chance that kid transfers. So how do you then keep depth if you keep recruiting those guys and they keep leaving? So the philosophy almost has to be, you've got to take like a 4-star, 5-star guy, a program changer, as often as you can. But just about every year, you've got to take a guy that's like borderline for your conference.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who's just kind of happy to be there. So if you're a top tier team in the SEC, you're taking a guy that could probably start for one of the bottom tier teams in the SEC, but certainly is not your level, because that guy's the guy that's not necessarily going to transfer. He's happy to be at, I'll use Alabama, for instance, because this was not Alabama. This was not Nick Saban, but he's happy to be there, and he is going to stay the whole time.
Wasn't Mac Jones a 3-star?
I believe he was not a 5-star.
Bryce Young, Heisman, he was not Trophy Bryce Young, winner,
correct.
5-star. He, yep, wasn't Tua.
Correct.
Here's a good example of a guy. Stetson Bennett.
Yep.
He was a walk-on at Georgia, transferred out, came back in, and all he's done is held the job with JT Daniels, five-star super stud at a modern day. Yep. That's a great point. Like, you now there's going to be guys that are almost fringe because they're going to stay.
Yep.
Like, they're staying, they're going to be there. So if, cause here's like Sam Howell.
Yep.
He was the program builder for North Carolina. You now know if you're Mac Brown in this cycle, go get another five-star.
Yep.
Because the five-star doesn't have to wait because Sam Howell's moving on to the NFL. And they've got to do roster management now, early signing days on the 15th. And first of all, early signing days ruining college football. We'll get to that in a minute. Yeah. But now it's, you've almost got to hire what amounts to a GM to
100%
to look at rosters now, almost like a salary cap.
And coaches have, as part of the recruiting departments now, they have like people that are assigned only to the portal, and it's their job to both manage the incoming, scouting the people that are potentially coming into the program, and evaluating, like, hey, kind of keeping the temperature of, hey, like, we could lose this guy. I use, for example, my alma mater, Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech struggled this year. If you haven't kept up with Georgia Tech, had an outstanding running back who was a sophomore, second year freshman, in Jahmyr Gibbs. Well, Jahmyr Gibbs, and they had a very deep running back room. Jahmyr Gibbs decides he wants to take his talents elsewhere. Jordan Mason, who's a very good player behind him, decides he's going to go to the NFL. And then they had two running backs who didn't really see carries, another running back that didn't really see carries behind Gibbs and Mason, that has felt like his time's up at Georgia Tech. So now he decides to go and leave. And so someone has to be keeping the temperature with these guys. Like, yeah, hey, we will probably lose this guy. This guy's sort of borderline NFL, and coaches kind of have a running list in their head and their position groups, but someone's got to aggregate that and do exactly what you said, like roster management. Here's where we project we're going to be. Here's how many scholarships we project to have. Here's how many transfers we can do. It's wild, man. It's crazy.
You know who else you got to manage during the transfer portal era? The parents.
Yeah. And the high school coaches.
The parents know that they can get their kid to go play somewhere else without sitting out. Yep. And there's tampering going on. And there are situations where if your kid, and I'm speaking of one specifically, turns the ball over a little bit and gets benched and they don't like it, parents are going to get right in there and yank their kid. Yep. Gone are the days where, you know what, man, you fumbled it on two key opportunities. We can't trust you. And by the way, you got an NFL back ahead of you, so you're not going to play. We're going to get through this together. Well, no, you're not. Mom wants him to transfer, or dad wants him to transfer. And I, you know, between that and I keep saying we'll segue to early signing day, but what's the advantage now? Because people were screaming for this early signing day. Well, now all it does is it gets coaches fired before the season starts. It puts people in a bind with hiring a coach, rushing through the process, doing a coup for a guy that's still in a job while you're a job that's not even open.
Right.
It's caused so many problems where they need to get rid of December 15th, go back to February. And if you don't like it, sorry, you can't have everything you scream for.
And I feel like this is one of those situations where, like, we as college football people have to be able, like, be big enough and mature enough to say, hey, look, guys, we tried this and the unintended consequences of it were not worth it. We were screaming for early signing day, and I honestly don't even remember what the loudest reason was, but I believe it was because, well, we felt like these guys have been committed for so long, we should give them an opportunity so you're not getting decommitments after the season and all this stuff. And it's like, okay, the timeline for all that stuff has just moved up. And as you said, like, now it's important to have a coach in place as soon as you can after the season, as soon as you can, really, period. I mean, you had schools like Texas Tech, Georgia Southern, hiring coaches during the year while their teams are still playing games. UConn, like, that doesn't need to happen. Let the product on the field, let the players, let their season end. And like, when you're on a bad football team, wins matter. So it may not matter to a fan whether they finish with two wins or four wins or what the distractions are going around it, but the experience for the player, which is ultimately what this is about, the experience for the player is a worse experience when you basically got a head coach looking over your shoulder for the last 4 weeks of the season.
And there has to be a way, and I know you're right, one of them was that they've been committed so long, let them do it early, but there's another argument that said, well, they want an early enrollee if they want to start the semester there.
Well, we did it in those days too. Like that, we still had early enrollees. I mean, there were guys in my class that enrolled early. I don't know what exactly the logistics of it were. I think
neither do I.
Yeah, but it was possible then. It's possible now, and maybe that was some of it. Like you wanted those guys to have the pomp and circumstance of signing day, even though they were going in January. That was probably part of it too. But
now it's just it's bad.
Yeah,
and if I'm a college coach, like you might want to get some early signing day guys, but I would build my roster with portal guys all the way to February. Unless I've got a guy that, like you said, has been committed forever. It's like, hey, you're committed. Let's sign and get it over with. But the priority that it's now placed on recruiting much earlier than it has, because now, Rod, what we're talking about, we've got transfer portal, early signing day, NIL, and bowl game opt-outs.
Yeah.
And I just don't think any of that is the way to talk about the greatest sport we have, because it's all about, that's all about movement and me, as opposed to the we of it, finishing what you started and then moving on to the next thing at the appropriate time.
And the biggest thing that you can't really put back in the bottle with that is bowl game opt-outs. Like that's not something that we're going to be able to wrangle back in. So let's adjust the rest of the calendar around the fact that, like, ultimately these bowl games now, because of opt-outs, because of what the college football playoff has done to a lot of the sport, as much as it's grown the sport, because of the way that it is built up, if you're not making it, guys are leaving and not taking these bowl games as the final opportunity to prove themselves and all that. We can adjust the signing day calendar a little bit. Even if you don't want to back it all the way up to February, you could back it up to around Christmas. You could back it up to just after the new year, because I don't think these coaches are really going to kick and scream about having during bowl season, right, unless they're in the CFP. I mean, you know, we talked about Sam Howell earlier. Sam Howell has thus indicated he's going to play in the bowl game, but if he doesn't, like, Mac Brown knows, hey, my opportunities of winning this bowl game, while important for record and all that stuff, are not as good without Sam Howell.
Right.
So let me go find the next Sam Howell for 5 weeks instead, or for 4 weeks while getting ready for this bowl game, rather than hammering everything out for this team. I think some of that was the pushback early on from coaches, but I don't know that would be as strong a pushback anymore. I haven't talked to coaches about that one, but I don't think it would be.
And I think there needs to be, now, as we've seen it all out there, we yelled about players getting played in NIL. Fine. You got NIL. You're just going to see the beginning effects of that. We haven't even started to scratch that surface.
Yeah.
You got NIL, you got the one-time transfer rule, which we are seeing heavily now with these guys knowing that they can go. And we've got early signing period. And you've got people complaining about the 14 playoff. At some point, this all leads to the bigger picture conversation of maybe we do need a commissioner.
Yeah.
Like someone who oversees the sport. Because there's too much. I mean, it's just too much to handle.
I completely agree. And there's so many parties that have their own interests at heart. Like, I mean, each of these commissioners serves the 14 or however many schools in their conference. As much as they serve college football and they are the stewards of college football, they're representing their constituents. Well, each one of those constituents has their own motivations for how they want the rules to be. For example, like, you've had Dabo Sweeney and Nick Saban come out very publicly against a 12-team playoff. They don't want it. It would make sense why they wouldn't want it. Not saying this is the entire reason, but it would make sense. They have benefited from a 14 playoff system. It has worked for them just fine.
Right.
But with the commissioner of college football, that person can take all of that, distill it down to, all right, what is the best for the sport going forward? While it may not be best for the SEC or Conference USA or the Sun Belt or the ACC, it's best for the sport as a whole. So even if there are a couple of quote unquote losers in any individual decision,
yeah,
the sport wins. And so there needs to be someone that's taking care of where the sport's going.
The final domino, we believe, Then again, I've been doing this podcast long enough to know that it's never going to be final. But the final domino in the coaching world happened with Oregon making their hire of Dan Lanning, their new head coach, taking over for Mario Cristobal. I found that a risky hire for Oregon.
Yeah.
I find it a puzzling hire for Oregon, but it appears that put an end to the craziest, silly season we've seen in quite some time. And it'll be interesting to see how that hire not only affects Georgia, but how it works with Oregon. Because if I was Oregon, I wasn't doing this search, but I'd have found someone that would have been content staying there for life, or someone that was from that region that doesn't want to leave the Pacific Northwest. Because anytime you bring in someone that's not from that area, it's all well and good until South Beach and Cuban Coffee starts calling and you're gone to the sun, and I don't blame them.
Or Tallahassee in the case of Willie Taggart. That one, I found the hire, while in terms of like young up and coming head coach, if you're trying to get in the ground level of a head coaching career, Dan Lanning's a good one to get in the ground level of. Someone was going to give that guy a job eventually. But if you're Oregon and you are a place that has been burned twice now with consecutive head coaches, on coaches with connections to the Southeast that have gone to the Pacific Northwest with varying levels of success, and then when a better or more favorable job for them comes open, leaves, I'm with you. I would have tried to find someone with the connections to that side of the country where at least the draw of geography was going to be part of it. With Dan Lanning, it's just not going to be that. So I don't know, man.
I might catch it for this, but it's a podcast that we give our opinions. I don't think Oregon's as good a job as people make it out to be. Wow. I just don't. I think it's a nice job. I think it's a good job, but I don't think it's a great job. And I'll tell you why. Look at the history of Oregon pre-Chip Kelly.
Yeah.
He made that place into a national power. They've kind of struggled since. Mario goes in there, goes to the Rose Bowl, wins the Pac-12. He elevated the recruiting. But the reason I don't think it's as good as people believe, you hear the same thing with Oregon every time. I'll ask you this. Why is Oregon considered a good job?
Because of Phil Knight.
Okay.
Nike, money, like
facilities. That's it. But who doesn't have that now?
Now everybody, they were on the cutting edge of that, even under Mike Bellotti. Like they had started that with Joey Harrington and that crew where they started the ascent there.
But everyone has that.
You are correct. It is a much tougher job with a functioning USC than I think.
That was my final point. They have taken advantage of USC being down.
Yeah.
That was exactly what I was going to say. When USC's up, hell, when Washington's up, when USC's on, game, set, match, you're not winning the Pac-12.
Yeah.
And they've preyed on that. And I'm telling you, as a Pac-12 guy, getting kids to go to Oregon is difficult. Mm. Mario got Kayvon Thibodeau. That was an all-world signing.
Justin Flo.
Chip Kelly, he was winning with two stars because he had a schematic edge because no one was doing what he was doing.
And he was dipping into Texas for a particular type of player. Like he wanted speed, and he largely and somewhat controversially, maybe, like, I mean, that's confirmed, right? Like that was something that he got in trouble for. Had the connections in Texas to get guys to go to Oregon. So like Oregon's not going to be able to rely on local recruits. It has to be highly developmental. The Kayvon Thibodeaux probably aren't going to continue to go to Oregon with USC at the top of its game.
There's nothing there but football and the campus. I mean, I've been there a couple times. It is hard to get in and out of. It's the Pacific Northwest. It's cold. It's beautiful, but it's cold. Yeah. It's all there is. Look, credit Phil Knight and credit everything Oregon did to get that into a good program. But I would classify that as good, not great. And the Lanning hire is going to be interesting because if he does prove that he can do something there, do you think he's going to stay?
No, I think when one of the bigger blue bloods comes open, he's gone. And I'm not sure. I think if you're Oregon, you have to make a decision whether you're okay with that. Like, are you okay with hiring the young up and coming star that's not going to be around for long? And it seems like with the Lanning hire, that's what they decided to do. Cause I think they thought Taggart and Cristobal were going to be around for much longer.
So the coaching carousel was absolutely nuts this year. I forget what the total number of jobs are, but when your domino effect opens up a program like Oklahoma and Notre Dame, when that's your domino effect, you know, it was crazy.
I've got a question just about the coaching carousel for you, because we always see these programs. A lot of them, particularly with any sort of heritage, will hire somebody with connections. And you kind of got that Virginia Tech with Brent Pry, although he was a GA in the mid-90s under Bud Foster. So while there is that connection, I think he identifies with the place. I don't think it's as strong like a Brent Venables at Oklahoma. When you see like Brent Venables at Oklahoma in particular, let's talk about that one. Like, what did you think of that hire? Because he's a first-time head coach with a personality that is not a typical head coach CEO personality. Not correct to say you can't change it.
Okay, so make no mistake about it. Bob Stoops hired Lincoln Riley and Bob Stoops hired Brent Venables. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Bob Stoops has made this hire twice.
Yeah. He was right the first time. So
I was surprised that it was Venables, but I'm not surprised that Oklahoma stayed within the family because unlike any other sport, connectivity matters in college football and they will find anything to justify it. From GA to, oh, he got his business degree here, whatever the case might be, people will find a way to make it work. And so the Venables hire is going to be interesting because he reminded me of Bud Foster, a lifelong defensive coordinator, brought his lunch pail to work, and he's the guy that's going to beat you up for four quarters. Yeah. Will that work at Oklahoma? I mean, he got a good offensive coordinator to try to keep Caleb Williams. He got Lebby away from Ole Miss.
Yeah, it's a great hire.
It's a great hire. So we'll see how it works. It's like our guy at Notre Dame.
Yeah. Marcus Freeman.
Yeah. Marcus Freeman. He's a defensive coordinator, first time head coach. Yeah. Notre Dame and Oklahoma are two power programs. And so we're going to get a good idea really quick. And they needed what I think both programs coveted and needed was stability and safety with their hire. And I think both got that.
I do agree with you there. And I think the connection to the school helps Brent Venables, particularly when you look at the fact that sometime early in his coaching career at Oklahoma, they are transitioning to the SEC. And that is going to change the math for Oklahoma for a number of different reasons. Not saying that Oklahoma is not going to be good in the SEC. Not saying that Oklahoma's could not win the SEC because they absolutely could. It is much tougher to win the SEC or to walk into an SEC schedule thinking you've got 10 wins than it was in the Big 12 for a myriad of reasons, obviously players, but also environments. Like, there are two stadiums in the Big 12 that have over 80,000 people in them, and they are Oklahoma and Texas. So Oklahoma on a regular basis does not play in a stadium that's not friendly that has over 80,000 people. You've got like seven of those in the Southeastern Conference. And will that make a big difference on the field? Probably not, but it does make a difference when you walk into some place and you don't have your A game. So we'll see.
I would say this, and I don't know how much it mattered, but I'd be willing to bet you'd see different hires at some of these jobs, if not for the early signing day, where you could wait and maybe get through the holidays or the college football playoff or the bowl games or what, like, I think a lot of these hires had to be done, and I don't know that some of them would have been done if not for the early signing day. All right, let's wrap up here on a Monday edition of the ESPN College Football Podcast. Bowl games get started this weekend. Friday, you got two of them. You got the Bahamas Bowl and the Tail Greeter Cure Bowl, Northern Illinois, Coastal Carolina. And that one, Saturday, a full slate. Give me the one bowl game that you're looking forward to watching this weekend, either the 17th or the 18th.
Can I cheat and give you two?
Absolutely. These are our rules.
There we go. So I am really interested. I think first and foremost, the fact that Northern Illinois gets to play against Coastal Carolina sheds some light on the Northern Illinois story.
Yeah.
This is a program in 2020 that did not win a game last year. And all Thomas Hammond did was go beat Georgia Tech, my alma mater, and then rolled to a 9-4 season, 8-4 in the regular season, win the MAC championship. So from winless to winning the MAC this year, it's an excellent coaching job. He did it with a Michigan State transfer quarterback in Rocky Lombardi. And then playing Coastal Carolina puts them on the stage where that story is going to be told and it's going to resonate. Now, on the field, we'll see how they stand up. But everybody thought they were going to get boat raced in the MAC championship game. Kent State was a big favorite in that game, and they ended up winning it. And they won it going away. So that one. And then the other one that I'm really looking forward to is this. It's 11 o'clock game. It's the roofclaim.com Boca Raton Bowl.
Yeah, I like that one too.
I love it because you got Western Kentucky. Everyone's talked about Bailey Zappe all year, that big high-flying offense. And then you contrast that against an App State team that likes to run the football. They're tough, hard-nosed, play good defense. And they've been a good team this year. They have not had the level of performance that I think they typically expect. Like, they expect Sun Belt championships every single year.
Right.
But a win against a good Western Kentucky team should be a really good matchup. So I'm looking forward to that one from a matchup standpoint.
So you've got that one. That's at 11 a.m. Eastern ESPN. You have the PUBG Mobile New Mexico Bowl, UTEP Fresno State. Got the Radiance Technologies Independence Bowl, UAB BYU. Lending Tree Bowl, Eastern Michigan Liberty. The Jimmy Kimmel LA Bowl presented by Stifel, Utah State, Oregon State. And then Louisiana and Marshall wrap it up in the Arnell Carriers New Orleans Bowl.
That late game too, Louisiana. Billy Napier has obviously moved on. How about the way that some of these coaching?
Let me create PUBG, the PUBG Mobile.
Oh yeah, yeah.
How PUBG could you Mobile that? New Mexico Bowl. That,
how could you do that?
You got to get your the bowl sponsors, very important to us. PUBG Mobile New Mexico Bowl. Just put that out there. And I did another one. I completely butchered another one. The LA Bowl presented by Stifel.
Oh, okay.
Stifel.
I would have gone Stifel too.
So like it's all the record. I got them Stifel. Right. Stifel, yes, and PUBG.
You won't be hearing from the higher ups. The suits will let you off the hook. But while we're sort of talking about the coaching changes, Louisiana and the season that they've had, Billy Napier finally winning the Sun Belt, the way that he hired, the way that he handled that, taking the Florida job, I think everybody around, we talk to people around the Louisiana program, everybody kind of knew this was coming at some point. Like, yes, they've been kind of on pins and needles for a few years, but him taking the job, coaching the championship game, them winning the championship game again, like that experience for the players understand taking the Florida job. Like, no player is going to sit there and be like, man, I can't believe Coach Napier took the Florida job. But the way you leave on the way out is important. That's what textbook. Players remember.
It was and textbook.
That's the way you should do it. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. You want all the, for every Brian Kelly and Lincoln Riley, there's a Billy Napier who got it right. Right. And congratulations to him on his career ascent. So, hey man, this was fun. Good talking ball with you again.
Absolutely. It's always fun. I have to say, like, I may go back into the withdrawal mode if I don't hear from you next week.
All right. So I've been alerted while we're doing this that our coaches calls for both Maryland and Virginia Tech likely next week.
Excellent. Before
we will get to talk again next week.
Oh, good.
And then we got the bowl game the following week. So things are looking up.
Man, at least till the new year. This is good. This is going to be a good December.
And then we'll get into spring ball, and before you know it, it'll be regular season again.
Let's go. Counting down the days.
So for Roddy Jones, I'm Matt Berry. Hope everyone has a great rest of your week, and thank you for listening to the ESPN College Football Podcast.